Good day, everyone, and welcome to The Medley. I'm your host, Blake Crash Priddle, and this time on The Medley, we're going to be speaking with American actor, producer, and writer Frank Crim. You might recognize him as Firefighter Frank from the TV show Barney and Friends from the 1990s. But he's more than just Firefighter Frank. He's going to tell you all about his fascinating career as a writer, producer, and actor, and he also has some really good tips for aspiring screenwriters. What ignited your ambition to get into the television and film industry?
Since I was like 4, 5, I remember telling my family when I was 6 that someday I would win the Academy Award, you know, and they all laughed. And I started doing theater when I was, I have 5 older brothers, and my mother was a singer, and the 6 of us, we sang together. We were the Crim Boys. And we sang 6-part harmony with my mom on the piano, and we sang all over Oklahoma and Kansas, Missouri. And then as my brothers got older, they wanted to play sports, and I went into the theater. About the age of 6, I started doing plays, and not just school plays, but community theater. There was a theater downtown Oklahoma City that I used to go to all the time. One of my neighbors would take me with him. And I've just always wanted to be an actor my whole life.
So I guess Oklahoma City has a theater scene.
I think as most cities do, we had a theater called the Mummers Theater, which is now since long gone. It was a very bizarre building, and it was sad to see him tear it down. But it was a bad design. All of the heating and air ducts were on the outside of the building, so it was always having issues in the summer and in the winter. But it was a great theater in the round, and I saw a lot of great shows there. And then Lyric Theater of Oklahoma at OCU during the summer is a very well-known regional summer stock company. And my mom would take me to see the plays there. And then there, what's funny is a lot of older actors that I admired as I was growing up, eventually, once I got to be an adult, all became lifelong friends. People that I watched growing up that inspired me are now calling me for advice, mainly for film. They were all theater. I was, you know, now Oklahoma City has a big, there's a lot of movies and TV shows being shot in Oklahoma because of the tax rate. It's a rebate. And so there's a lot going on there. But for the most part, there was always theater going around. Oklahoma Shakespeare Company, Lyric. You know, there's a lot of good theater, a lot of good community theaters, Carpenter Square, Jewel Box is now gone, but Jewel Box was a staple. They had like a 3,000 member patronage of an audience. So, every time I did a show there, it was sold out every night.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think one of your first on-screen gigs was that of a firefighter on Barney and Friends. How did you land that role?
So, Not my first credit, but probably one of my first big starring credits, because I worked a couple of days on that. And I used to teach at the Young Actors Studio and Performance Center in Los Colinas, which is a suburb of Dallas, when I was living in Dallas. And when I was in Dallas, I did over 30 commercials, national network. Regional. I was working all the time, but I taught at the Young Actors Studio, and a bunch of those students on Barney were students from Young Actors Studio. And David Joyner, who's the guy in the Barney suit, him and I were teachers at that studio. And I remember my agent called, and I had an audition for Firefighter Dave for this show. And I didn't really know it was a kid's show. I wouldn't pay attention to it. I knew David worked on it, but I didn't know anything about it. And I go in for the audition and I do it. And then usually you hear when you audition, you'll know within a day or two if you get a call back and you go back and do a read again, or if you got the part, if you're even in the running. And 6 months went by and my agent calls and says, so you booked that gig on Barney. And I went, what gig? And she says, Firefighter Frank. I said, I don't remember auditioning for Firefighter Frank. And she goes, oh, I think it was originally Firefighter Dave. And I go, okay, so great. You know, how much does it pay? When do I work? That stuff. And then I show up and there's David and there's all of these kids from the studio that I knew were on the show. So it was really like walking into a very familiar place. And I know that show has gotten a lot of negative things about it. And it really sucks that people just want to burn something down for the sake of it. But that show, not just was the show a very positive thing for younger people, and it teaches kindness and love and, you know, how to behave and how to be a good person. You know, there's a lot of good morality things there. But what really struck me on the set was how much of a family the crew was. From when they broke for lunch, nobody ate until everybody came to eat together. The administration staff, the crew, the actors, anybody working on that show, everybody ate together like a family. And that really, after all these years, that really had a big impact on me. So when I hear people bad-mouthing it, I just shake my head. Well, this is always going to be haters. You know, they're making fun of something that they don't know about. And if they knew what a positive impact that show had on so many people. And believe me, Blake, you're one of thousands of people who've come up and talked to me about Firefighter Frank. I could win the Academy Award and people would say Firefighter Frank won the Academy Award. I'm never going to get away from it. And I learned out over the years that I should embrace it. And I do. I see David. David lives in my neighborhood out here now, and I see him every now and then. And it's just great to see him, because it was such a positive experience to be on that show and be included in it. And I'm very grateful.
Well, certainly sometimes people might make fun of Barney. Like sometimes my parents and I would have made jokes about it as I got older. But the one thing that my parents actually told me recently is that when I was little, it was a show that kept me quiet and kept me occupied, and it gave them some time to themselves, which was a win-win scenario. Before you played Firefighter Frank on Barney, did you do anything special to prepare for that role? Like, did you go to a fire station yourself, or did you talk to some firefighters or anything like that?
Kinda. I knew I knew firefighters. I had friends that were firefighters, and at the time where I lived next door to two. There was a fireman on the left of me, and then a fireman across the parking lot who I knew. I grew up about a half a block from a fire station. As a kid, used to go there all the time and talk to the fire guys. There was a joke on the set. The dinosaur that played the little yellow dinosaur. I'm blanking on his name right now. And we're standing around, and he thought I was a real firefighter. And he asked me, "What's the biggest fire that you've ever been to?" And I looked around, and a bunch of people were looking around. And he was young too. He was a little person, but he was very young. And I just, as a joke, I said, "Oh, that'd be a five alarm fire." And then they go, "That's five stations." So everybody and the dogs, and I've, you know, on Barney, I had a dog, said, "Everybody's going to that fire." And he, "Oh my God, that's amazing." And we played it along until at the end of the day, I went up to him and said, "I'm not really a fireman." And he laughed, and everybody laughed and got a big joke about it. But I would have people ask me all the time. They thought, being on that show, they thought I was a firefighter and an actor. In all due respect to all the firefighters out there, I don't have the courage to do what those guys do. Those guys are real heroes.
There was a dog on that episode too, a Dalmatian named Chief.
Yeah. 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 That dog was great. I'm more of a dog person now than I was then, but that dog was so professional. That dog hit his mark better than some actors I know. Very, very gentle and stuff. But yeah, a lot of the technical stuff, there was a technical advisor on the set that was a firefighter. And when they wrote it, they'd consulted him and some other things. And so when I got the script, pretty much all of those things that I was teaching are what firefighters would go to a school and teach. Like if they went to like your grade school or you know, a kindergarten or someplace like that, and they were giving information, basically what I was teaching on the show, if I remember correctly, what was in the script was what they actually teach young people, like the drop and roll, crawl, you know, how to get out of a burning building is you don't run through it. You drop and get underneath the smoke and things like that. I learned a lot of stuff about myself.
That's what I learned too in school and from real firefighters growing up myself. And I just remembered something. When I was in grade 9, I played Sparky the fire dog at a boot drive, and it was really hot in there, let me tell you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, yeah, it's the uniform. They had me in the whole gear. They didn't have me. They put the whole stuff on, the mask, the air tank, all of that. That weighed, I think the air tank was like 30 pounds. And imagine going through a fire, trying to fight a fire, wearing all that equipment. These guys got to be in shape, man. You know, I was overweight when I did that show. I was nowhere in the kind of shape that I should have been in or need to be in if I was an actual firefighter. The Barney suit itself is like 60 pounds. And David, they were constantly having to take breaks, take the head off and let David cool off. There were fans inside the costume. Physically, he impressed the hell out of me that day. The first day I saw him and what he was actually having to do on a physical, because that's performing as well. Because a lot of acting, there are some things that are very physical.
I saw David Joyner on the documentary series about Barney called I Love You, You Hate Me, which basically outlines the negative press that Barney received. Did you watch that documentary? And if you did, what did you think about it?
I actually have not seen it. I meant to see it, but sometimes I don't have the luxury of time to watch a lot of things I want to watch. If you look at my queue on my TV on how many shows I'm supposed to be watching that I haven't watched yet, it's kind of ridiculous. But I also write a lot, and I'm currently producing a series of Shakespeare videos. I've got two scripts in the work. I got another one we're trying to raise money for. I'm just working all the time. At my age, you know, I kind of have to, because, you know, it's that day is coming when, you know, as I've gotten older, the roles have gotten fewer.
I just thought of something else about firefighter Frank. You had mentioned putting all of that gear on, which was really heavy. And I remember on the episode, one of the kids tried on some of the gear and said that the stuff is heavy. And I remember that the boots were really big and the jacket, it was made me laugh when I was a kid.
Yeah, it still makes me laugh thinking about that girl that did that. She was just engulfed in it. The boots, the hat, the coat, you know, it just swallowed her up. That was very entertaining, because I didn't know they were going to do that. And she was such a good sport about it. You know, all those kids were great. You know, that whole team. The most important thing I could say about my time on Barney was I wish they would have had me back. I could have used the you know, every actor needs a gig, right?
Yeah, that's what Barney said, that if you want to be big enough to wear that kind of gear, you got to eat your fruits and vegetables and get plenty of exercise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. I have a nephew who is an EMT, and I have a great nephew that just passed his EMT. So, and then, you know, I have lots of family in the medical business, but I have two guys. They're EMT. They're firemen, but they're EMTs. They're fire EMTs, if that makes sense. They work out of the fire station.
What is your favorite on-screen role to date?
I would have to say, probably the last one I did, Call Me Cat, which was a lot of fun because I got to work with Swoozy Kurtz, who's, you know, an icon to me. I played Mickey Cohen, who's a real life gangster, on Netflix's show called Hollywood. I knew who Mickey Cohen was, and then I did a lot of research and I had his voice down, and then I show up on set and the director says, yeah, don't worry about the voice, just do you. I'm like, oh, I just did all that work. And I got to work with Jim Parsons from Big Bang, who just, oh my God, this guy blew me away. He was so, and I didn't know at the time we were shooting it that he was an executive producer on the show, because the show hadn't aired yet. So sometimes when you go in for an audition for something, you have no idea what it is because it's brand new. So there's nothing to look at. There's no reference. You can't watch an episode to see what the tone is. What's the tempo and any of these things like that. And so I'm going in kind of blind, and Jim was so gracious. And so I've never worked with an actor who could ad lib during when I'm taking a breath. So I've got my dialogue, and I would take a breath between a sentence or whatever, and he would get something in. He didn't step on my line. He didn't interrupt me. He didn't kill my flow. He's right there. If anything, he was just feeding me the energy and the tone of what the scene was about. And I was just so impressed with him and because he made me better. But playing that icon, the iconic character who supposedly is the one who killed Bugsy Malone and took over, you know, the history of this guy is pretty amazing. So I would have to say, in short memory, it'd be that one. But God, I've been so lucky. I haven't had any, like, I've never been a guest. I've been a guest star, but I've never been a series regular or a recurring on a TV show where you get to develop an arc and a there's a real through line where you're headed and stuff. You know, I show up, I work one day or 2 days and I'm gone. You know, when I first got here, the first very sitcom I did, I played a blind maintenance guy and none of the series regulars talked to me. Nobody said hi. Nobody bothered to know my name. And it was very disheartening. But I did my job and I left, you know, and ironically, none of those actors are working today. I'm kidding. But I don't think so. But it's that thing where I've been on other shows, like recently being on Call Me Cat, Maya Bialik, just a sweetheart. She comes up, she introduces herself. She asked me if I wanted to get a picture when we were later. And I said, absolutely. And she, yeah. And then when it was all over, I remember one actress, I asked her for a picture and she was nowhere to be found. But Mayim comes up and goes, did you want to get that picture? I'm like, oh my God, this is why you're you. This is why you're a star, because you treat everybody like they're somebody. And unfortunately in Hollywood, you only hear about, you know, the bad actors in terms of, in bad acting, I mean, people that have crappy personalities, you know, they're mean to people or they're rude or they think they're better than everybody else. And that's such a small percentage, but it's like 90% of what you hear on in the press, Access Hollywood, all that crap. They only, you know, because they just want to lead with all the negative. Nobody wants to talk about the positive. And there's so many positive things in Hollywood that people never hear about. You know, it's a reason why it's the city of angels. There are a lot of angels here, man.
Well, I do know here in Canada, a lot of people have started their show business career in Halifax, Nova Scotia, where I'm currently living. And a lot of TV shows were filmed here as well, like Trailer Park Boys and all kinds of cool shows. And there's a big theater scene here too. You had talked about how you've written, directed, and produced some of your own movies. What are some of the other projects that you worked on?
I started producing theater with a girl who's a friend of mine. And we produced a couple of plays, and then we ended up producing a short film called Survivors, which was a spoof on the show Survivor. It was one of the first films that was up on Atom Films, A-T-O-M. When the internet first started, this is how old I am, Blake. I remember the world before the internet. That was really great. And then we did another short film called Blonde that I wrote, which was about a blonde actress killing off all the other blonde actresses in Hollywood so she could get a job. And it was basically a 15-minute blonde joke, but it was interesting. I directed it and I got into some festivals. I think we got an honorable mention somewhere. And then I recently wrote a short film called, and starred in it, called Home Auto Life, where this guy gets kidnapped by these thugs and they're beating the crap out of him, trying to get him to talk because they think he's a secret agent. Turns out he's just an insurance agent and he's trying to sell them an insurance policy. It's really dark. I mean, I get the crap beat out of me, but it's got some comedy at the end of it. That one I got into a couple of film festivals in that. I was a producer on a movie called Zen Noir that won a couple of festivals. We won an award, Best Producers at Moondance Film Festival. And then I'm trying to do a series of Shakespeare monologues, and I did Bottom's Dream. I shot it in Griffith Park, total guerrilla style, just me, a cameraman, and a director running around the Griffith Park looking for Peter Quince and Snout and Tinker and Bellow, all of the guys that abandoned him in the forest. I don't know if you know Midsummer Night's Dream, but it turned out really, really well. And then I just shot Iago in Oklahoma City when I was home over Christmas. I haven't started editing that because I just haven't. My system won't handle it. I'm trying to upgrade and I don't have the money for it yet. But I'm also working on a Western. I'm working on another script that's probably going to if it finds a home anywhere, it would be like Lifetime or Hallmark. It's kind of a cheesy little rom-com kind of thing.
On your bio on LinkedIn, it said that you started and co-founded a couple of production companies. What's the secret to starting and running a successful production company?
So if you're looking at Four Men and a Guy, we started Four Men and a Guy. So I had a guy, a gentleman by the name of James Denzella, who I was writing with. And we wrote like eight scripts, a couple of TV scripts, a couple of film scripts. One of them is called The Family Hitman. There's a TV, which is about a guy who looks like a major gangster. And there's a confusion of the mafia thinks he's this guy, but he's really this Joe Schmo. And we pitched that to Joe Mantegna and some other people, but you got to get past the gatekeepers, the agent, the manager. And if you don't have money to offer them, this is what we'll pay you, they won't even read it. So it's harder to sell a script than it is to get an acting job, because everybody's got a script. You know, it's so the business since the phone and the internet, everybody's got a script. Everybody's, you know, in on it. And that's fine. Unfortunately, there's a lot. It just makes the talent pool much more diluted, because there's so much inferior products out there that are getting in the way of the really good ones. But we started Four Men and a Guy. So it was me and my writing partner and a director by the name of Guy B, who directed and produced Third Watch. He was the Steadicam operator on ER. He established the look of ER. He's gone on. Criminal Minds. I mean, the guy's resume is ridiculous. And he came on as a director in our group. And we had another producer writer by the name of Courtney Jones, who does a lot of independent films. And he's now up in Seattle area making feature films for no money, which are great, proving that you can make a movie without $1 million. And then another gentleman by the name of Grossman, who passed away last summer. And he was somebody that I met on the set of a pilot and got hitting it off. And he'd worked on so many classic TV shows. This guy's his wealth of knowledge of all of these shows he'd worked on and produced that were like legendary to me. And we became friends. And then turns out that Guy knew him and Courtney knew him. And so we had a meeting and we formed the company Four Men and a Guy, and the guy being Guy B, which is hence the name. We have yet to sell a script, but we've developed probably 9 or 10 scripts between TV and film that are ready, projects that are ready to go. We just need somebody to give us a green light. Dreaming Dog Entertainment started with my producing partner, Erica Gardner from the theater that we started out with. We produced The Blonde and we produced Survivors. And then there was another movie we produced, but we got shut down because we were trying to shoot it without permits and the cops came and killed it. We had a couple of names in that came and worked for free, and then it never got. We had an outside source that was working with us, and then that person just kind of disappeared, which killed the project. And this is common. You would be amazed at how many projects get started and never get finished.
I know that the entertainment and the media industry in general is very competitive, but are there any resources out there for aspiring filmmakers or screenwriters that may be struggling to find a studio that accepts unsolicited material?
Yes and no. The no side of it is nobody will accept an unsolicited script. But you can get it solicited if you can just get an agent or a manager to submit it for you. And if that agent and that manager is a legitimate agent and manager, then it's not considered by most unsolicited, because you have representation. If you, Blake Priddle, sends in your script, chances are they'll never open it. But if it comes from an agency or a management company, that's all you need. Or the other way to go is Coverfly or Shore Scripts, Inktip, I think it's called. So these are websites that you can submit your scripts on, and you can they have these contests all the time. And sometimes you got to pay, you know, $35 to $50 to submit in it. But if your script is good, and let's be very clear, talent always rises to the top. If you send in a script and it's got something that's unique, or it's just so well written that they can't ignore it, they're going to look at it. And most people are going to look at it because they don't want to be the ones who passed on it. In voiceover work, I was doing a workshop with Terry Apple, and Terry Apple's very famous voiceover talent. And I was taking her class, and she brought in her representation, which was CAA, which was probably the biggest agency in Hollywood. And he said that if we send in a tape, he would listen to it because he didn't want to be the one who passed on the next big thing. Because he passes on it, and then William Morris signs you, and you make the biggest deal, and they missed it because they didn't listen to it. That's just good business. And in something I always emphasize on everybody that I talk to, Blake, is this: is it's show business. It's not show friends. And you need to understand that everything you do has to at least come from some part of understanding how the business works.
Frank, this interview has been amazing and just totally inspirational and then some. And I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Medley this week.
Yeah, I'm happy to share any of my knowledge with anybody, especially somebody that's an up and coming. But yeah, I listened to a couple of your podcasts. I was excited to be on the show, and I'm very grateful that you had me. Thank you. Thanks for being a fan.
And that was the multi-talented producer, actor, and writer, Frank Krim. I hope that you enjoyed this edition of The Medley, and remember, we're all kinds of different.